Good afternoon, Dr. Stulpnagel.
Hi.
As the judge has indicated, I'm going to be basically doing what's a cross-examination based upon the questioning of Mr. Pantone. And given scheduling issues for you, I'm also going to cover in my examination of you things which I would have covered had I called you independently.
Thank you.
So, to some degree, I'm going to start at the beginning. You indicated to us that your title today is Senior Vice President of Operations.
Yes.
Can you tell the jury what your job duties or what your job responsibilities are in that position?
Yes. I have responsibility for overseeing all of the research and development departments, including chemistry, molecular biology, engineering, informatics, including the manufacturing of our organization, services, intellectual property, and business development. I think that's it.
Sounds like plenty.
It's a lot to do, yes.
Can you describe, we've heard quite a bit discussed about the fact that Illumina was a startup company when you founded it. Can you describe for us the characteristics of a startup company based upon your experience in working in the venture capital area?
It's an intense and a curious environment where survival is far from certain. Most startups fail, so to really be successful, you have to have total commitment, you have to work incredibly hard, you have to have a little bit of luck and some good technology and some good people behind you, and contributions from as many people as you can.
Now, you've had an opportunity based upon your employment with CW Group, and before that, Avalon Ventures, to observe various compensation schemes that are used in startups, correct?
Yes.
And you remember Mr. Pantone asking you about equity as a component of compensation.
Yes.
Although you haven't been here, we've had some testimony from Dr. Zarnik about the vesting schedule that related to the restricted shares he was allowed to purchase at the outset. Can you describe for us why did Illumina in this case have the restricted shares vest over time?
I'm going to object, Your Honor, on the grounds of relevancy, 352.
Overruled.
Vesting is a normal function of stock that's either allowed to be purchased by an employer or options that could later be purchased by employees. It's part of the compensation program. So you earn that stock by staying and working hard for the company. It's intended to increase your motivation, so you are aligning your interests with those of the rest of the investors. A large portion of your compensation is due to the success of the company, and certainly that's in everybody's issue. But specifically, it vests over a period of time to retain you as an employee. If you leave for whatever reason, termination, voluntary departure, or fraud, whatever, criminal activity, it doesn't matter. The stock stops vesting, and whatever portion you had not vested to that point returns to the company. You didn't earn it, so you're not going to get it.
I'll object and move to strike that latter portion.
Which portion?
The notion if he's fired for any reason. This whole case is about illegal firing.
It's all subject to later determination of a jury or court.
Right.
But I think that's understood.
Okay.
Dr. Stulpnagel, at the time that you were putting together Illumina and identifying candidates for the senior scientific positions, you identified both Dr. Zarnik and Mark Chi in conjunction with Larry Bach, correct?
Yes.
You are aware that Dr. Zarnik came to Illumina from a company called Irori, correct?
Yes.
Do you have any information about the degree of job security, if any, that Dr. Zarnik had at that prior employment?
Yes.
Objection.
What's the basis of your knowledge?
Conversation that I had with Dr. Zarnik directly.
And as to which the door has been opened. What did Dr. Zarnik say to you in your conversation with him about the degree of job security he had at Irori?
It might come with an exception to the hearsay. What is the relevance? Do you want to say that outside the presence of the jury?
Probably so. I'm sure counsel would.
You want the court reporter?
No, we don't need a reporter.
Okay. Don't discuss the case during the recess. We'll be in recess until 2:05. Why don't you go ahead and ask your question? This is a hearing outside the presence of the jury. Ask the question you were going to ask.
Okay. Dr. Stulpnagel, did you ever have a conversation with Dr. Zarnik about his... Let me restart that. Did you ever have a conversation with Dr. Zarnik in which he discussed with you his job security or his...
Did you ever have any discussion with Dr. Zarnik where he discussed whether or not he was happy at his previous employment?
No. What happened is we went outside Cardiff. There's a UPS drop box where we put next day delivery. And Tony and I stepped out to do that.
When was this conversation?
Summer of 1988 while we were at Cardiff. Right outside the building was this drop box. Tony started to tell me about his problems he was having at Aurori, and he was really glad the Illumina opportunity came along because he was starting to look for jobs. He knew he had to leave Aurori, and more specifically, he said that Aurori started to have meetings where he was excluded and meetings were, which were done behind closed doors, and he assumed that this meant that people were meeting without him, and he felt insecure in his job as a consequence of that.
Of course, Judge, Dr. Zarnik would deny that if that were put into issue somehow.
Yes. Here's the thing, though, just looking at this. I'm looking at what he has testified to. I like where I was. Impeachment. I knew I had to leave. I knew I had to leave. That impeaches that I like where I was.
I think my point is, I still think that if anything should come in, we shouldn't get into this notion of these closed-door meetings, allegedly, because this was a subject of a motion in limine. And we'd have to have a mini-trial on whether those meetings occurred, whether they were legitimate. The inference, no matter how cautionary...
What does it mean? If they didn't want to offer me the position that would move me, I'd stay?
Let me respond to that. It is the second statement that is also impeached by the...
Who is the they?
They meaning Illumina. This was in the context of a discussion questioning Dr. Zarnik about his negotiations with Illumina and the fact he was insisting upon having the CSO title... And his answer there was in response to questions about the negotiations. And he said, I liked where I was, and if they... And by they, he was referring to Illumina. If they didn't make me the offer that would move me, I'd stay. And that statement, it essentially is saying, if they gave me, unless Illumina gave me a good enough offer, I liked where I was, and I would stay at Aurori. His comments to Dr. Stulpnagel made it very clear that he wasn't going to be staying at Aurori. It's direct impeachment.
I knew I had to leave. That's direct impeachment.
Also, it's impeachment of the comment, I'd stay. He's told...
What about the closed-door meetings?
That's where I think it deals unfairly with character. And it's collateral. And all the factors under 352 suggest that that shouldn't come in.
Your Honor, let me make my record here by saying, first of all... The plaintiff himself was in Your Honor's chambers when you said the stuff about prior employment and prior problems and employment isn't going to come in unless the plaintiff opens the door. Dr. Zarnik was sitting right there. He indeed did open the door by volunteering that comment. And for Dr. Stulpnagel to simply testify, well, he told me he wasn't happy at Aurori, only allowing Dr. Stulpnagel to do that is going to make it look to the jury like he's just fabricating something. But having an explanation and a context in which the conversation took place is very important to the jury's believing the statement when offered by Dr. Stulpnagel.
Actually, the problem, Mr. Pantone, is this. Really, it is very unclear. I made it very clear. I even gave an example. I said this was out because I gave a number of reasons. Unless he opens the door, if he says something like, nothing like this has ever happened to me before.
That's the example you used. Nothing like this has happened before.
That would open the door. Here he says, I am. He testifies in court, I like where I was. Unless Illumina made me a very good offer, I wouldn't leave. But in fact, he said he knew he had to leave because he was uncomfortable there. They were having meetings behind closed doors about him. I can't read my own writing. What did he say after that?
Decisions being made in which he wasn't asked to participate. Meeting where he wasn't asked to participate.
He felt insecure at his job.
Yes, and particularly bothered by the closed-door meetings because he didn't know what was going on.
In other words, since Dr. Zarnik opened the door, why should we hinder what is clearly impeaching evidence of his testimony that he was happy?
For the same reasons I articulated in the motion to begin with.
I understand that, but it changes it, though. It's kept out, and then he tries to use it as a sword instead of a shield.
He didn't in the sense... He didn't say...
He tried to create the impression to the jury that he was completely happy there. He had to be lured away to Illumina. And if you believe, and I understand he'll deny this, but if you believe, I have to assume for purposes of the testimony that Dr. Stulpnagel is correct in his testimony, but further, what I'll do is this. I'll give you a limiting instruction to say that's the only, that may be considered only for the purpose of impeaching his testimony, only as it relates to his credibility, may not be considered for the truth of the matter about whatever the situation was on the other job. If you request a limiting instruction, which I assume you do.
That's a safe assumption.
So when the jury comes back, how much more time are you going to take on your examination?
I probably will go to the end of our court day today, but I expect to be done.
I'd like to finish, but there may be some more cross-examination based on new matter you bring up.
Okay, I'll do my level best.
I'd like to get this over with today. What I'll tell the jury in response to the question, are we on time, it's too soon to tell. We're kind of pushing toward, well, maybe I won't even say that. It's too soon to tell.
Is there any possibility that if we are running over that we extend the court day or not?
Well, my problem is that I have 500 other cases, and this was the time I used to read my law and motion on the other cases, and so there's a good hour or so I spend after this.
Sort of like our office.
That's a problem. Do you think it will do any good to give them some reassurance if we start bumping up against the 4th of July? We'll probably create some time around the 4th, extra time for them around the 4th of July?
I think we're going to do it.
I was going to ask you, too. I was going to ask you to actually sit down together and work out a schedule. In fact, I can even tell the jury we're trying to schedule everything out definitively.
In advance.
By Monday. To work out a schedule that will be complete, day by day, who the witnesses are, and that includes not only the plaintiff's case, but the defense case as well.
I think we both should and will. This applies to me as well as Ms. Kearns. When we're doing cross or redirect, let's not rehash the same thing that's covered.
I think lots of things. I think they are kind of cumulative. This stuff about the whether or not Dr. Zarnik was recognized as a founder, it's in the documents. They say what they say. I don't think that's the most important issue in the case. I understand that's an issue, but I think you have to start trying to prioritize. Realize that there are some limits, and we can't lose the jury, or in the worst case, have a mistrial because we lose too many jurors.
I do have that in mind.
Okay, so we'll reconvene at 2:05. The record will indicate all the jurors are present, counsel and parties present. You may continue your examination, Ms. Kearns.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Stulpnagel, at or about the time, did you ever have a conversation with Dr. Zarnik in which he shared any information with you about his employment at Irori, which was the company he was with when he was hired for Illumina?
Yes, in the summer of 1998, while we were still working out at Cardiff, Dr. Zarnik and I had a meeting. The meeting happened to be by the UPS drop box where we did next-day drops for Express Mail. And he told me that it was very good that the Illumina opportunity had come along, because he knew he had to leave Irori, so the timing was perfect for him.
Did he say anything to you? Did he elaborate on why it is he had to leave Irori?
Yes. He said that the senior managers were starting to have meetings where he wasn't invited to attend. He didn't feel that his opinion was as highly valued, and perhaps most particularly, he was worried because there was meetings where doors were closed.
Did he tell you anything else to explain why he had to leave Irori?
That's pretty much all. I think that's it.
As to this, you are requesting a limiting instruction? As to this entire line of questioning, since the recess, the following limiting instruction applies. This testimony is limited only to the, as it may bear upon the credibility of the testimony of Dr. Zarnik, it's for that purpose only.
Not for the truth of the matter.
It's not to prove that these things that are alluded to by the witness actually took place, but it's only offered to the extent it is inconsistent with the previous testimony of Dr. Zarnik.
Now, Dr. Stulpnagel, in the summer of 1998, Illumina was being operated out of CW space in Cardiff?
Yes.
During this period of time, in this morning's questioning by Mr. Pantone, Mr. Pantone asked you a question in which he referenced David Walt. And I understand that you weren't here when David Walt testified the other day, so you don't know what it is David Walt said. But he asked you whether you would agree with the comment that he attributed to David Walt, that Tony Zarnik showed a passion and enthusiasm in the summer of 1998. Do you remember that question to you by Mr. Pantone?
Yes.
Let me ask you, first of all, during the summer of 1998, did you have an opportunity to observe Dr. Zarnik's work ethic day by day, week by week?
Yes. In fact, to the best of my recollection, I had the only keys to the office. And so the only time others could be in the office at CW Group, people from Illumina, would be when I was there.
And during the summer of 1998, did David Walt have the ability to, or opportunity to, observe Dr. Zarnik's work ethic day by day, week by week?
No, Dr. Walt was in Boston area.
And so, what were your observations of Dr. Zarnik's work ethic while Illumina was working out of the space in Cardiff?
Incredibly poor. He typically would arrive kind of mid-morning and then be around for lunch, maybe hang around for another hour or two, and then be gone for a couple of hours, and sometimes he would come back, or not, during the late afternoon. So, typically, he was there anywhere from 4 to, say, 6 hours, and maybe there was a couple of days where he was there for a full day's worth of work.
What kind of hours were you putting in during this period of time, summer of 1998?
I typically got to work around 7 in the morning, and I typically left 6 to 7 at night.
What sort of hours was Mark Chi putting in?
Mark would typically arrive about 8, and he and I would leave about the same time. Sometimes he'd leave a little bit earlier.
And Steve Barnard, did he join during the summer of 1998?
Yes, he did. He had approximately the same hours as Dr. Chi.
And Dr. Auger, an engineer, did he join during the summer of 1998?
Yes, he did.
What sort of hours did he keep?
Approximately the same hours as Dr. Chi and Dr. Barnard.
Did Dr. Zarnik spend less time at the facilities than any other person affiliated with Illumina during the summer of 1998?
Any other person that was working at Illumina full-time.
So, like Dr. Todd Dickinson was a consultant, Dr. David Walt was providing consulting, but anybody that was considered to be full-time, whether they were listed on the payroll or not?
Absolutely.
During the summer of 1998, did any person comment to you, let me ask you this, were you displeased with the amount of time that Dr. Zarnik was spending?
Yes, and it was one of the issues that we brought up in the counseling session of August of 1998.
Did anybody else comment to you upon Dr. Zarnik's work ethic during the summer of 1998?
Yes, our administrative...
Objection, hearsay.
Sustained.
Without getting into the content of any communication, can you identify the person or persons who commented upon Dr. Zarnik's work ethic?
Same objection.
Sustained.
Did you have any other concerns regarding Dr. Zarnik's performance that arose during the summer of 1998 beyond the number of hours that he was on site?
The most blatant and quantifiable was this business plan. It was the critical function deliverable for the summer of 1998 and consisted of 10 or 12 different sections. I outlined the whole project for Mark and for Tony, and at the end of the day, Tony contributed about 4 pages to an 80-page document, and that was only after I had to assign him specific sections like a fourth grader.
And with respect to the preparation of this business plan, you say, Dr. Stulpnagel, there were approximately 12 different sections that comprised the plan?
Yes.
Did you have any meetings between, among you, Dr. Stulpnagel, Dr. Chi, and Dr. Zarnik, concerning the preparation of the business plan?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, I'd outlined all of those sections and gave Mark and Tony a copy of that outline and said what we need to do is pick sections and start working on it. Let's communicate with each other and tell each other which section you are working on. Let's bring them together, and then we'll put it together as a full business plan.
When did this process begin?
It began almost immediately in June of 1998 and continued until the first week of August 1998.
And during this period of time, you indicated in your testimony just moments ago that at some point in time you had to assign sections to Dr. Zarnik. Is that correct?
That's right. In July, most of the sections had either been written or Mark or I had committed to writing them, and Dr. Zarnik had contributed nothing. So, I had a meeting with Dr. Zarnik in my office and said, Tony, we need to have you make a contribution here. So what we made was an executive summary, an industry summary, And then there was two small sections within the business plan, one to do with high-throughput drug screening and the other to do with binary encoding, both of those being areas in which Tony had some expertise. I said, you are responsible for doing these.
So is it accurate then to say that from the time you began working on this in early June up until sometime in July when you assigned sections to Dr. Zarnik, you didn't see any output or any written contribution from him?
There was nothing.
And that's what prompted you to assign him some sections?
Yes.
Did he object to the sections that you gave him?
No. I think he kind of smiled sheepishly and accepted the assignment. He realized he hadn't done any work on this important project.
Did he in fact provide you with drafts of the sections which you ultimately assigned to him in July?
Yes.
Did you give him a time frame within which you were requesting his draft?
I don't remember, but, you know, I think they were delivered within a week or two.
In terms of the timing...
Actually, I remember now, I was disappointed particularly with the executive summary section, because all the other pieces that were done, and we were still waiting for the executive summary, and Tony hadn't delivered it. And so I said, Tony, just read the business plan and pick out sections and make the executive summary. You wanted the executive summary, you've written the plan, now make a summary of it. To my surprise, he delivered that by literally cutting and pasting exact sentences from the business plan into the executive summary.
So when you said to him, read the business plan and take bits and pieces, I take it you didn't mean it literally.
No, absolutely. I expected him to understand what anybody would understand with a summary. You take the information and you condense it. You write it so that it flows naturally, not disjointed sentences from page 23, for example, and page 41.
Did you expect him to review the business plan and to, for lack of a better word, to summarize it?
Yes.
I'll object. It's leading, Judge.
It is, and it's getting cumulative.
So you received these drafts from Dr. Zarnik of the sections you articulated for the business plan. Did you have to revise any of those sections?
I completely rewrote the executive summary because it was so poorly done by Dr. Zarnik.
Did you make any revisions to the other sections?
I think we all made minor revisions and edits, but I don't think I made wholesale changes like I had to do for the executive summary.
All right. Apart from the number of hours he was spending at Illumina, and apart from his lack of contribution to the business plan, were there any other performance concerns that you developed concerning Dr. Zarnik's performance during the summer of 1998?
Yes, with respect to strategic planning, trying to figure out what we were really going to do in this company, Dr. Zarnik didn't contribute nearly at the level of Dr. Chi or myself. In fact, he advocated for areas of development that were unsupportable based on the amount of information that we had in the technology and what was feasible. So he was suggesting, for instance, very high-risk opportunities where fundamental inventions had not yet been made versus Dr. Chi's position to follow genomics, where the fundamental knowledge of making oligos, putting them on beads, and doing hybridizations was well understood. And Dr. Chi had already come up with, prior to his employment, the fundamental expansion of this technology, the basic oligo decoding strategy.
We heard testimony from other witnesses about the close working conditions during these days at Cardiff. Did you have a formal meeting time scheduled for the team during that period?
No, it was more opportunistic. People were there, we got together, we solved problems, and tried to do that real time. There were no formal dates in terms of meeting times.
Are there any particular issues or issues that were addressed or meetings that were held that were significant in your view and in which Dr. Zarnik did not participate?
Yes, that was a key one. And that was really the development of our product, this array matrix that took arrays to a whole different level. That was the beginning of an invention I had when I was out running one day on a weekend. And I started thinking about this. I brought that concept back to the group in an afternoon meeting, and I believe it was on a Monday. Present in the room was Mr. Steve Auger and Dr. Mark Chi, and in that period of time, we had the fundamental invention of our first product, the product that we're pursuing today, the product that really differentiated us as a company. Dr. Zarnik wasn't there for that afternoon meeting.
Now, I understand from your testimony that you were concerned with the number of hours Dr. Zarnik was keeping. Was it simply a matter of you wanted for him to keep the same hours?
No. In fact, I think I testified that Dr. Chi and others were actually working a little bit less, and that's probably understandable. I tend to be a little bulldog about those kinds of things.
On his direct testimony, Dr. Zarnik talked about the summer of 1998, and his direct testimony was that you all worked about the same number of hours, and that at the end of each day, which was 6:30 or 7 p.m., work would wrap up because you would tell everyone, okay, let's call it a day, we're done for the day, or words to that effect. Is that accurate?
That's absurd. Anybody that knows me would never voluntarily ask people to stop working. We were under a lot of pressure. A lot of effort was required to get this company going, and I was working very hard, and so was everybody else. But we had hours where people terminated their employment at various times during the evening and just left as they concluded whatever tasks they were working on.
With the court's permission, I would want to approach the witness and just ask him to identify this piece. Since we've heard so much about bead arrays, I wanted to have him identify it, and then we'll have it available for the jury.
Okay.
Dr. Stulpnagel, can you please take a look at this item, safely enclosed in plastic, and describe what it is for the jury so that when they are able to handle it and look at it, they'll have some description of what this thing is.
So this is the array matrix. Each one of these sticks are actually a fiber optic bundle with 50,000 individual fibers on them. What's spectacular about Walt's invention is each fiber becomes an individual detector. What we did, we assembled these to match the wells in a microtiter plate. That's the way samples are prepared in large-scale experimentation. This contribution was the product that we developed that afternoon meeting.
And, Your Honor, would you like for me to have the witness allow the jury to pass it at this point or later?
Later.
Okay. Just for the record, this array matrix has been identified on our exhibit list as Exhibit 13.
Very well.
So, Dr. Stulpnagel, during the summer of 1998, did you develop concerns or dissatisfaction with the work performance of any other person who was dedicating full-time effort to Illumina?
Nobody other than Dr. Zarnik.
Let's talk then about the August 1998 walking discussion. Who was present?
Dr. Mark Chi and me.
Who initiated the discussion?
Dr. Chi and I talked beforehand about his observation. My observation about the lack of productivity and lack of effort from Dr. Zarnik, and we concluded that what we wanted to do is talk to and confront Dr. Zarnik about these issues man-to-man, and we wanted to do that in the context where other employees wouldn't be prejudiced about that discussion. It's a very small office, four offices, and as a consequence, Dr. Chi and myself took Dr. Zarnik outside the office. And if anybody knows Cardiff, what we did was walked up and down the railroad track area. There's a little walking path there. And we specifically addressed these issues with Dr. Zarnik about his productivity, his lack of effort, his poor performance on the business plan, and his failure with respect to intellectual property, the production of our core ideas, lack of focus on the product development, and most importantly, which was most important to me, all those were historical, but looking forward, we were on the verge of moving into our new facility September 1, and what I saw was no planning on his part in preparation for that. Our costs of being in business were going to escalate dramatically when we moved to these new facilities. We were going to have about $16,000 a month in rent payments. I saw no preparation so that we could order the supplies ahead of time, so we knew what kinds of experiments we were going to do right away when we got there. It's as if we had wasted that first 2.5 months to get ready to do the experiments.
What sort of preparation were you expecting to see?
Specifically, a research and development plan. Something that outlined what he wanted to do, what experiments, how he's going to prioritize experiments so that we could advance the core technology at Illumina as quickly as possible.
Did you ever ask him before this counseling discussion in August? Strike that. Prior to the counseling session in August, had you asked Dr. Zarnik to provide you with a research and development plan?
Yes, I told him I was expecting a research and development plan.
And did you expect a research and development plan for the entire R&D effort? In other words, molecular biochemistry or just chemistry?
Dr. Chi had already done this for the things under his responsibility. He did it in a form that was remarkable. He did it in the form of grant applications. Not only did I have the opportunity to review them, but milestones were well laid out. The intellectual thought behind it was extremely well developed. We knew precisely what experiments we were going to do at what time, and he was going to subject this experimental plan to third-party review, his experts, his peers, that would decide whether to fund this type of research or not.
Okay, so you are telling us that Dr. Chi, in fact, had provided you with a written plan in the form of grant applications showing the research projects that were going to be conducted under his supervision?
That's right.
You could ask for the same thing from Dr. Zarnik?
I didn't need it in the form of a grant application. What I needed was a plan, some thought and some intellectual power behind how to prioritize what activities we were going to start doing September 1st.
And you didn't get that?
No.
So during this, you also said that one of the concerns that you also had developed by this point was a concern over Dr. Zarnik's failure to make progress with respect to IP, or intellectual property. What is it you were expecting him to do?
Right away, I'd asked Dr. Zarnik to take the lead with respect to intellectual property. Again, protecting our ideas and also making sure that we didn't try to do things that others had already protected. He just failed miserably in this role. So I picked it up myself and managed the company's IP from that point forward until Ms. Nikki Espinoza joined the company.
Trying to keep your answer short, what do you mean? What activities are involved in protecting a company's IP?
Systems and processes. The systems were to set up procedures where people could document their inventions. And I asked specifically for him to do that. In fact, I spelled it out. He never put in an invention disclosure log. I did that. I asked him to get scientific notebooks, something that's routine in every scientific lab, where scientists would document their thoughts as they have them. He didn't do that. We even moved to our new laboratory facilities. We still didn't have these notebooks. Finally, Dr. Barnard stepped up and took the task after I found out where precisely to go buy these things. For me, it was a 5 or 10 minute phone call, and I gave it off to Steve, and he had it done in a very short period of time. So these are not big activities. What was more critical, though, besides setting up the right systems, was actually understanding what our IP was, how it differentiates from others, what's patentable, what's not, how to plan our research strategy so we didn't infringe on anybody's intellectual property. All those things are what I expect from a...
Did you know one way or another whether Dr. Zarnik had any prior experience dealing with identifying and controlling an IP portfolio?
I had no knowledge one way or another. It was part of his offer letter. He didn't bring it up as an issue where he didn't feel confident, so I thought he did have competency there.
Because he didn't do any of these things, you said you took on those tasks yourself?
That's right.
Did you have any prior experience in managing and protecting an IP portfolio?
In fact, at that point, I probably had less experience. Dr. Zarnik, at least, had patents issued, so he knew about the process. In my case, at that point, I had not had any patents issued of any inventions that I had made.
You basically had to learn this on the fly.
Yes. Fortunately, if you apply yourself with good resources, you can get a lot of things done. I had good help with outside counsel.
And this IP portfolio identification and protection issue, this is only one of the many duties that you were focusing on that summer.
Yes. I was writing the majority of the business plan, although Mark did help. He probably contributed 30%+. I was finding all the financing. I was continuing with my recruiting of key scientific members of the staff, and I was setting up all of the infrastructure of running a company. Things that you don't think about, payroll, benefits, all of the other things necessary to really make this a real company.
Now, focusing back again then on the Cardiff walking counseling session, you've identified a number of concerns that you developed about Dr. Zarnik's performance during the summer. You talked about your discussions with Mark Chi. As the two of you walked with Dr. Zarnik, what did you communicate to him? What did you say?
Exactly what I spelled out. The business plan failures, strategic planning failures, failures to really even make an effort. I can understand people not being capable, but what I can't understand is startup environment, not even trying. That's what I was trying to influence Dr. Zarnik about. And surprisingly, he was very passive during the whole meeting. Didn't really give us a whole lot of feedback. And at the end, he said that this environment was a difficult environment for him, partly because the commute was harder to Rancho Bernardo to Cardiff than to Torrey Pines, and partly because he was waiting to have laboratories to really do experiments. So he said, it's almost a quote, "Don't worry, when we get to our lab facilities, I will be there."
Did Mark Chi say anything during this walking counseling?
He had some input, but I led the discussions.
Did you consider terminating Dr. Zarnik's employment at this point in time, August of 1998?
No, I didn't. We'd only been together for a few weeks, and I took him at his word that when we got to a different environment, he was going to be a more productive employee.
There was some testimony given during Dr. Zarnik's direct examination, and he testified that he signed your offer letter.
Yes.
Did Dr. Zarnik in any way recruit you to Illumina?
Maybe I'll tell you how that all happened.
Well, no, just tell me whether he recruited you to Illumina.
Both he and Dr. Chi came into my office one day and said, "John, have you ever considered leaving the venture firm and staying permanently at Illumina?"
Okay. So maybe there was some ambiguity in my use of the word recruit. You were aware of the Illumina technology and the Illumina opportunity well before Mark Chi and Tony Zarnik came into your office and laid the question whether you might come on board as an Illumina employee?
I'd been working on this since November 97.
Why is it that Dr. Zarnik signed your offer letter?
Well, I was the acting president CEO. I was an officer of the company. I couldn't sign my own letter. The offer letter, in fact, was negotiated between the venture people, specifically a board member named Sam Colella, and me. And when we got to terms, I drafted it, wrote the whole offer letter, Sam approved it, and we gave it to Dr. Zarnik to sign because he was the officer, the next officer in the company.
So Dr. Zarnik didn't engage in any negotiations with you on your employment terms?
All Dr. Zarnik did was sign the offer letter I printed out and had approved for the board.
Now, you moved to the new facilities in September of 1998, correct?
Yes.
There was laboratory space there?
Yes.
To the best of your knowledge, had Dr. Zarnik done anything to order equipment, machines, or supplies for experiments?
No.
So you moved in what, the lab space was...
pretty much empty.
Except for hoods.
We had to scramble. I'll give Tony credit for this. He scrambled and got me a printer so I could have a printer, but this was the lack of preparation that was standard at that point in time. Some of the other scientists, Mr. Steve Auger and Steve Barnard, and certainly Dr. Chi, were buying some critical components, so other elements were coming along appropriately.
Was your expectation back in the summer of 1998, was it then your expectation that when you moved into the new space, you'd hit the ground running and begin performing experiments almost immediately?
It's unrealistic that everything arrives on day one. What you wanted to see was a plan and a schedule and an ordering process so those things could arrive in a timely manner.
And by the time you actually moved in, was there any written plan from Dr. Zarnik?
No.
Now, what were your observations concerning Dr. Zarnik's work ethic after the move to the new facility that had laboratory space?
It was marginally better. He wasn't gone for all afternoon. He'd come in typically a little bit later, like 9 o'clock, and he'd be there until 5. Some days he was there until 6, but it certainly wasn't at the same level of commitment as other employees. He was still the least working employee at Illumina.
He was the highest compensated employee at Illumina?
Correct.
During this time, let's say September 1st, 1998, when you moved into the new space, how many employees total in the company?
Mark, Tony, John, Steve, Todd, Steve. 6.
Now, during the months of September, October, and leading up to a discussion that occurred in November, let me ask it this way. Did any of the concerns that you'd formed in August or articulated in August, let me withdraw all of that. You articulated for us concerns you had formed during the summer of 98 and talked to Dr. Zarnik about in August.
Yes.
Did any of those improve significantly after the move to the new facility?
No.
Did you develop any new performance concerns after the move to the new facility?
I did become concerned because he tended to divide the organization between molecular biology and chemistry rather than trying to unite the organization. So that would have been a new concern.
What did he do to divide those two scientific groups?
It was kind of subtle and manipulative. He would make the chemists feel like they were second-class citizens, and other people were making them second-class citizens because they weren't the glory boys, they weren't developing the application, rather than take responsibility and say, hey, they were chemistry applications we could work on and try to meet some feasibility experiments.
Actually, that brings me to another point then, something that Mr. Pantone has already touched upon with you. It's true, isn't it, that during the summer of 1998, when you were still in Cardiff, the consensus was eventually reached that the first application that was going to be commercially pursued would be the genomics application.
It was prioritized, but the expectation was that we would continue to do research in the immuno, the binary encoding, the Tony Zarnik invention that later became a goal of his, as well as research into high-throughput screening feasibility and the ONOs. Those were chemistry, primarily applications.
You are saying, although genomics was prioritized higher, the intention was that these other application areas be pursued.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Under Dr. Zarnik's direction as CSO, were these additional research areas pursued?
Not in a material way. Not in a way that would justify more resources, because he didn't design the experiments that show basic feasibility. We did continue some R&D activity on the ONOs, as was required in our Tufts license agreements, and that was primarily conducted by Dr. Todd Dickinson.
Let me touch upon that, because it's been alluded to. Dr. Walt developed the technology?
Yes.
Dr. David Walt actually had signed away the rights to his technology to Tufts University, his employer, correct?
Yes.
And so in order for Illumina to acquire that technology, Illumina had to negotiate with Tufts University, is that right?
Yes.
And you were the person involved in doing those negotiations on behalf of Illumina?
Yes.
As a condition of that licensing agreement between Illumina and Tufts, Tufts insisted that you had to continue conducting research on the ONOS application?
Yes.
Now, while you were acting CEO and president, did you hold regular management meetings with your senior managers?
No. Again, there was not that many people that you'd have to have regular meetings. You just walked down the hall and talked to people or said, let's talk at such and such a time about this issue.
In the very early days, in September of 98, there were only 6 people in the company, right?
That's right.
And Rich Pytalewski came on board in November of 98?
Yes.
After Mr. Pytalewski came on board, did you hold regular management meetings?
No, that didn't occur until Mr. Flatley started them right after he arrived.
Were you interpreting my comment, regular management meetings, to mean like a regular weekly scheduled meeting at a set time?
Yes.
You are not suggesting that you didn't meet with or didn't talk to your senior managers?
No, we had, I guess those are regular. We had frequent meetings amongst all of us.
But they weren't necessarily pre-scheduled.
Some were pre-scheduled, but they weren't on a routine basis, like they weren't done every Monday at 1:30 in the afternoon.
Now, what contributions, if any, at a strategic level, do you recall Dr. Zarnik made?
I cannot think of any strategic contributions that Dr. Zarnik made to the company.
Did he make any contributions to Illumina?
Fairly, I think he did.
What are they?
He's a very likable person, very social person. I think he helped a little bit with the culture. So he helped with communication with the scientists. He popped popcorn for them, held boat races for them, and while these activities were kind of frivolous, they did help support the culture.
Now, Dr. Zarnik, in his role as chief scientific officer, was responsible for leading and directing the overall research activities of the company. Isn't that true?
That was the intent of a chief scientific officer, but Dr. Zarnik never met that goal. Right from the beginning, he insisted on the title as chief scientific officer, and this was really a concession in the negotiations on my part, and the documentable evidence for that is the fact that Dr. Mark Chi reported to me. We set this up because we knew that Dr. Zarnik had never been the CSO before. He didn't have the experience in genomics, and he didn't even have interdisciplinary experience. His experience was primarily confined to chemistry, and rightly so. So the goal, the intention, and I confirmed this with Dr. Chi prior to Dr. Chi signing his offer letter, was that the hope was Dr. Zarnik would demonstrate he could handle full scientific responsibility of the company. He never did. So the reporting relationship was never changed.
Let me ask you this. There were initially two scientific arms of the company, right? Chemistry and molecular biology?
That's not fair. There's chemistry, molecular biology, chemistry, informatics all work together to build this product.
I guess maybe my point was that from the very beginning, the very inception, there were only chemists and molecular biologists and engineers.
Steve Auger was an engineer.
Did you ever observe Dr. Zarnik doing anything to educate himself about the research or the concepts that were going on in any of the other scientific groups?
Shockingly, no. To the best of my knowledge, he never even read Mark's grant applications.
And grant applications weren't... The grant applications that Mark Chi had submitted weren't just for the molecular biology arm of Illumina. They were for Illumina the company, correct?
Yes, in fact, they drafted out more than just molecular biology. Most of the application itself was about the specifics of genotyping, gene expression, and to some extent, proteomics.
Now, at the time that you moved into the new facilities with lab space, did Illumina have an idea or a concept that was ready to become a product, ready for manufacturing?
No, that was the whole point. It was going to take years to develop a product like this.
And did Dr. Zarnik, were there any conflicts between Dr. Zarnik and anyone else on the management team about the speed with which we were pursuing commercialization of a product?
No, I think everybody bought into the timelines and the milestones, and then everybody was disappointed when we set them too aggressively.
We heard testimony about the fact that the company was started up with seed money, and I think that Dr. Zarnik agreed with me the seed money the company had was going to make it last for about 6 months. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Did Dr. Zarnik, to your observation, did Dr. Zarnik seem to be managing his group and his responsibilities in a manner consistent with the limited funding of the company?
There were instances that bothered me. One particular one was a recruiting dinner between he and Dr. Steve Barnard, where I had to reimburse him for over $200 for dinner for two people.
What were your observations and impressions of Dr. Zarnik's management style vis-a-vis the people who reported to him?
Management is a funny thing. Not so funny, but there's a spectrum of manager styles, from very direct to a very laissez-faire, hands-off style. Current management strategy is really situational management. Knowing that you have different tasks and different people, you should manage those activities and those people according to whatever style is most appropriate for that situation. Dr. Zarnik had one style, and that was completely hands-off management style.
Let me jump ahead then to the November of 1998 time frame. What was your overall assessment of Dr. Zarnik's? What was your overall assessment of Dr. Zarnik's performance during the months of September, October, November 1998? In other words, after the move to the new facility.
I continued to be disappointed. His hours had only marginally improved. He had not delivered on the R&D plan. I didn't see a logical process to the experiments that were being done. And so we had a meeting. We had a meeting in which I prepared handwritten notes ahead of time because I realized I didn't get through to him in August. He hadn't changed his behavior, so I went ahead and meticulously developed three pages of notes that I used as an outline for my private conversation with Dr. Zarnik. We talked about and tried to be very fair, the positive things that he had contributed to the company, where he had disappointed me and the company, and most importantly, what was going to happen if he continued to act in the way he did. And I remember there was three precise things that I predicted in November of 1998 if Dr. Zarnik didn't change his behavior. The first was that he was going to be marginalized. The second was he was going to have less respect. And the third is he's going to have less responsibility.
I'd like the witness to open your exhibit book and take a look at what we've marked as Exhibit 23. I'd like to publish this to the jury on the screen.
Object to that on the grounds we talked about earlier.
I'm not offering to admit it, but I'm offering to put it up.
What was the state of this at the time of the trial readiness conference? Was there an objection to this?
No.
It was made this morning. We discussed it.
I'm going to sustain the objection, maybe when we get to that point, when there's some excerpt on this that you want to refer to. Refer to line by line in testimony in any way.
Dr. Stulpnagel, referring to Exhibit 23.
Yes?
Can you please read your notes? Now let me again confirm. When did you prepare these written notes?
These. What I did, I always worked on an 8.5 by 11 notepad that was bound, and I would write notes chronologically, and I literally kept stacks of notes. What these are is portions from those stacks of notes all kept together chronologically.
And so when is it that you prepared these notes? You say the meeting that you had with Dr. Zarnik occurred in November of 1998.
That's correct. And in fact, there are notes that are the outline that I prepared in advance of that meeting, and those are marked Exhibit 2154 through 2156.
Actually, the exhibit numbers may have changed since then.
Oh, 2330 through 2332. Are those the right numbers now?
They are. Your Honor, may I approach the witness with his original notes?
Yes.
Dr. Stulpnagel, what is this notepad I've just handed to you?
These are the notes that I prepared in advance of that November 98 counseling session that I had with Dr. Tony Zarnik.
You prepared these notes specifically as an outline for the discussion that you plan to have with Dr. Zarnik?
Absolutely.
You created them before you actually had the conversation with him?
Yes.
Can you please check the Court Exhibit 23 against the original notepad, the pages in the original notepad which are tabbed, and tell me whether the court exhibit is a true and correct copy of your original handwritten notes?
It is.
Can you please read line by line what your notes say?
I will.
It's hearsay, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Dr. Stulpnagel, can you tell me the general categories of topics that you intended to discuss with Dr. Zarnik?
Yes, there were general categories where examples of contributions that Dr. Zarnik made, examples of unfulfilled expectations, the first category of which was lack of leadership, the other specific failures. Then there was the time away from Illumina, the issue of commitment to Illumina's success, and he realized we all depended on him, we all needed him and everybody else for our survival. And there were some themes that I was going to try to weave into the discussion, science, business, motivation, and then the consequences, which I already discussed. That he became marginalized, less respected, and have less responsibility if he didn't alter his performance and his behavior.
Now, recognizing that I did testify with some specificity, even before I showed you the notes about what you talked to Dr. Zarnik about in November of 1998, do you remember what some of the contributions or positive things that Dr. Zarnik had done were?
He had made a couple of paper inventions. They included the idea of binary decoding, which later became a goal to have him show feasibility. Another paper invention called in-bead screening, which there's never been any further experimentation to prove whether it's going to work. He identified an important employee, Michael LaBelle. He helped set corporate culture. He did the one portion of the benefit program around the 401k. He had the rollover issue for his own 401k, so he wanted to be sure that got instituted quickly. In terms of unfulfilled expectations, he didn't show leadership in chemistry. On the coding issue, when we talked about oligo or binary, he didn't show leadership on in-bead screening, not on the ONOs, not on the high-throughput synthesis. And there's specific failures, much of which I've already testified to. Things like strategic planning, business planning, grant writing, preparation for meetings, etc., including here a notation that I didn't think he was preparing well for the SAB meeting that hadn't even happened yet. We're nearly 2 months away from the first meeting, and I wasn't seeing the type of activity that I expected him to be showing in preparation for that SAB meeting.
Dr. Stulpnagel, could you please take a look at the original notepad and tell me whether there are any notes in that pad immediately preceding or after these notes, which were related to your November 1998 meeting with Dr. Zarnik? Are there any notes in that pad reflecting thoughts or bullet points that you intended to discuss in a meeting with Mark Chi relating to his performance?
No.
And looking in that same notebook, Are there any notes that you have in that notebook relating to any conversation that you purportedly had with Dr. Zarnik in November of 1998 about the company not meeting its goals?
No, these are all specific around Dr. Zarnik, and there's no notes about the company not making its goals or milestones.
And if you had had such a conversation, say if you had such meetings with Drs. Zarnik and Chi, would those have been the types of conversations that you would have documented in these notepads?
Calls for speculation, lacks foundation.
Maybe you can establish custom and practice.
What were the circumstances under which you would create these handwritten notes on letter-sized notepads?
When I'm preparing for significant meetings, I often make notes to myself so I can make sure I cover all the subjects that I want to cover and make sure that the meeting is as productive as possible. So if I was going to have the same kind of meeting with Dr. Mark Chi that I had with Dr. Zarnik in November 1998, there would be notes here.
Now, you are not representing to us that you covered each and every bullet point in those notes with Dr. Zarnik in your meeting, were you?
No, it wasn't that kind of discussion where I said, Tony, you failed A, B, C, D, and E. It was a conversation, but I used this as a template, an outline, so I could be clear in my communication with him, so there would be no misunderstandings.
If you had had conversations with Dr. Chi and Zarnik in November of 1998, in which you were telling them that the company wasn't meeting its scientific goals and expressing great concern over that, would that have been a circumstance significant enough for you to have put in your notebooks?
Absolutely.
And you don't see any such notes there?
No, I don't.
You have retained the originals, or actually I may have them in my office, but you have kept the originals of all of these notepads, correct?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, yes. Up until about the fourth quarter of 2000. So in around the December time frame, I changed my habit, where from there forward I ripped out and filed things going forward. But up until the period which we're covering here in the trial, that was exactly my pattern.
So let's talk now about the November 1998 counseling meeting. You have outlined what you discussed with Dr. Zarnik, right?
Yes.
What was his response?
He said, well, I'll get a research plan to you. He didn't really have a whole lot of response, unfortunately.
Are you saying by this point in time, November of 1998, he still hadn't provided you with a written research plan?
That's correct.
What was his demeanor like?
I don't really recall. I think it was pretty nonchalant. I don't think he really believed that he had failed like I perceived him to be failing.
Did you put Dr. Zarnik on any sort of performance management plan at this point in time?
I made the specific request to have a written R&D plan, and either in this meeting or shortly after this meeting is when I assigned him that NIST ATP grant. I wanted tangible things he could deliver to me.
There was a question by Mr. Pantone on his direct examination of you in which he asked you whether Dr. Zarnik hadn't told you at some earlier point he either loathed or detested grant writing. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and now that you've said that, I think it was actually in this November meeting. So we did talk about grants or his failure to identify and write grants, and I think in that, this precise meeting, he said he loathed and detested grant writing.
Let me ask you generally, are there some aspects of your job that you dislike?
Oh, yeah. We all have things about our job we don't like, but for the good of the company, we do them. That's the expectation here with respect to grant writing. Grants were an important vehicle for funding our development.
And isn't it true that grant writing is something that would be expected of any senior scientist in the company, including the chief scientific officer?
Yes, particularly at that point where money was incredibly scarce.
So when you assigned the task of writing the NIST grant to Dr. Zarnik, you knew it was a task that he didn't particularly want to do, right?
We all do things we don't want to do.
Did he object?
No.
Did he say, I so detest grant writing that I really don't want to do it?
No. In fact, my impression was that he absolutely accepted that it was his responsibility. It was his time to contribute in this way.
What was the significance of this NIST grant, if it had been approved?
Two things. One is it would allow us to expand our scientific breadth into new areas of applications, ones that related specifically towards Dr. Tony Zarnik's expertise, that around high-throughput drug screening. And the other is a pure financial one. It would help us leverage the money that we had gotten from the venture capitalists, money that comes at a tremendous cost to the company, and move forward to the science without having to seek additional funding quickly. And the third one is credibility. When you have grants reviewed by outside third parties, investors respect that. Outside third parties have looked at these R&D plans. They've said these are acceptable. We're going to give you government money. We think it's good enough for the government to give you money based upon these plans, so there's an outside validation of what you are doing technologically.
Okay, would the amount of funding for this NIST grant, $2 million, have been a significant infusion for the company?
Yes, we only raised $8.5 million approximately from the venture capital community, so this was significant.
Let me focus upon the division of labor among the management team. Who on the management team was responsible for identifying potential collaborators for the company?
We all shared that responsibility because we all had contacts, or hoped we had good contacts outside the company, and that would allow us to make introductions for Illumina.
Did Dr. Zarnik ever identify or recommend any potential collaborators for Illumina to get involved with?
Just one, to the best of my recollection, and that's a company called Park Davis. It's a company he used to work for, and he allowed or made arrangements for us to talk to somebody by telephone at Park Davis during the summer of 1998. To the best of my knowledge, that's the only contact or contribution that Dr. Zarnik made from a contact's point of view for business development.
Let's focus for a moment, then, on business development. Let me ask you to just limit your answer to the period of time from the beginning of the company up until April 6, 1999, when Dr. Zarnik had his breakdown. Up until that point, before the breakdown, were there business development meetings which Dr. Zarnik was not involved in?
Yes.
Were there business development meetings during that same time which Mark Chi was not involved in?
I believe so.
During that same period of time, was it routine? Well, was it common for Illumina to make a business development presentation that did not include each and every member of senior management?
Absolutely.
What criteria did you use in determining who would go to the business development meetings or presentations?
Well, the number one criteria is what application were we going to be discussing with the partner? If it's a genomics application, Dr. Mark Chi is absolutely world famous in this area. He brings just incredible credibility in genomics. Having him there to answer the scientific questions was incredibly valuable. So most of, but not all of, the genomics business development meetings included Dr. Mark Chi. Very few included Dr. Zarnik. He had no expertise in genomics, and he contributed not at all to the few meetings that he attended. The other criteria was how much it was going to cost the company. If we had to fly across the country to meet with somebody and the airline ticket was going to be $2,000 because we were doing it the last minute, we may have considerations about how we're going to spend our money and do we want to spend that $2,000. So we tended to trim down the group as a consequence of that. On the other hand, chemistry business development business applications always included Dr. Zarnik.
Who were some of the chemistry business development partners or potential collaborators with whom Illumina met?
The Dow Chemical Company and later Chevron, although Chevron happened, I believe, after the April 99 period.
So is it your testimony that before April of 1999, there were business development meetings, particularly in the genomics area, that did not include Dr. Zarnik?
Routinely.
And it's also your testimony that business development meetings that involved a chemical or chemistry application did involve Dr. Zarnik?
Yes.
And in fact, the Chevron discussions resulted in a collaboration agreement, correct?
Yes.
Dr. Stulpnagel, we had some testimony during your direct about a company known as ABI, PE Biosciences, Perk and Elmer. There was one more, but in any event, you are familiar with this company, right?
Yes.
And Illumina entered into a deal or a contract with ABI, right?
Right.
Who identified ABI as a potential collaborator?
I think the first time ABI became aware of us was in November of 1998, as a result of a presentation that Dr. Mark Chi gave in the Boston area. Subsequently to that, I went to ABI's sister company called Celera in January of 1999 and presented our technology, which overlapped very nicely with Applied Biosystems and the investigator there. Dr. Emily Windeen had previously been employed by Applied Biosystems and worked very closely with Applied Biosystems. Shortly after that meeting with Celera, Applied Biosystems contacted us and we arranged our first meeting in mid-February 1999.
And were you involved throughout the relationship between Illumina and ABI? Were you involved in negotiating, documenting the business deal?
Yes.
Did anyone, any person affiliated with ABI, ever say anything suggesting that seeing a talk given by Tony Zarnik was the reason or was one of the reasons that ABI became interested in Illumina?
No. The only conversation of that nature was a private conversation that I had with Mike Hunkapiller that I later related to Tony Zarnik in approximately the April or May time frame, where Mike Hunkapiller said, "It's great to see this technology. I'd seen it once before at a presentation that Dr. Zarnik had given."
Did he make any kind of qualitative assessment of the presentation he'd seen given by Dr. Zarnik?
I don't recall that he did. And he wasn't the one responsible for initiating the contact. We got elevated to this level when the discussions got very serious, but more junior people identified Illumina and began the discussions.
Now, who participated in negotiating the terms of the ABI deal on Illumina's side?
Dr. Mark Chi and me.
And what sort of effort or time commitment was involved in working out the ABI deal?
Enormous would be the word I would use. It was a lot of work.
Over what? Maybe to give us a context, when did you start working on pursuing ABI? How long did it take until a deal was in place?
We started in February of 1999. We executed the deal in November of 1999. So approximately 9 months, 10 months, and in particular, it intensified over the spring and summer and fall.
Who was responsible for closing the deal with ABI on behalf of Illumina?
I held that responsibility primarily.
What contributions, if any, did Dr. Zarnik make in negotiating the ABI deal?
No material contributions.
What contributions, if any, did Dr. Zarnik make in documenting the ABI deal?
No material contributions.
And what contributions, if any, did Dr. Zarnik make in closing the deal?
No contributions.
None whatsoever.
Pretty much put that one as none whatsoever.
Did Dr. Zarnik ever come to you and say that he wanted to have greater involvement with this ABI deal?
I don't think so. I don't remember that.
If he had made such a request, would you have honored it? And if not, why not?
You wouldn't have done that because you have a team. Once you get started with a process, chemistry, personal chemistry matters a lot. These deals get based upon your relationships you develop. The last thing you want to do in the middle of a negotiation is bring a third party into it and alter that chemistry.
Do you believe that there's anything about Dr. Zarnik's training, experience, or background that would have added value to bringing him into the deal once underway?
None whatsoever. The key contribution there was Dr. Mark Chi, whose technical expertise was well known by Applied.
Now, is it accurate that part of what Illumina agreed to do for ABI was to deliver to ABI a number of these arrays?
Yes.
And isn't it true that in order to create these arrays, there is work done at Illumina by a number of groups that pull together to make this product?
The entire company, for the most part, is focused on making these arrays.
And some of what goes into making the arrays involves chemistry, correct?
That's correct.
And some of what goes into the arrays involves engineering?
Correct.
But ABI was purchasing or was contracting to have Illumina produce these arrays for a specific use. Is that correct?
That's right.
What was the use or intended use for which ABI was contracting to have Illumina make these arrays?
Okay.
Now let's jump forward to the April 1999 timeframe. Before I discuss that meeting, let me ask you a couple of preliminary questions, Dr. Stulpnagel. You are aware that Dr. Zarnik is claiming in this lawsuit that you froze him out and treated him differently after April 1999 when you learned that he suffered from depression?
I'd go even further. He says because I knew he suffered from depression, this was the result. Those are absolutely false statements.
Dr. Stulpnagel, do you have any personal acquaintances or family members that suffer from depression?
Objection, Your Honor. We dealt with this.
This is subject to limiting instructions?
No, it's different, Your Honor.
Let's take a 10-minute recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 20 minutes after 3. Please remember the admonition not to form or express any opinions about the case, not to discuss the case. We'll be in recess until 3:20. 3:20. What is your offer of proof?
The motion in limine.
What is your offer of proof?
My offer of proof is that the very people who are accused of discriminating against and ostracizing Dr. Zarnik because they'd learned he had depression are people who have close family and friend who suffer from the same condition, that they do not have a discriminatory bias. It goes to bias and motivation. Whereas the motion in limine was one brought by the plaintiff to prevent us from disclosing medical information about his daughter, about his brother, and that's fine.
Privacy.
We're not going to have these witnesses identified by...
You say there's a contention by the plaintiff, for example, that Dr. Stulpnagel is prejudiced against people who have depression.
That he discriminated against Dr. Zarnik because he has depression. I think the fact Dr. Stulpnagel has a family member, and we won't require him to identify the person by name, but has a family member who suffers from the same condition, I think is probative as to the issue of whether or not he is biased against and discriminates against people with this condition.
I think it's collateral. There's no way for me to test the veracity of any of this, of any of his testimony. The motion in limine was actually to exclude all third-party medical information.
That's because you were invoking privacy. He's willing to waive. You can cross-examine.
It's someone else's privacy.
Furthermore, Your Honor, with respect to Dr. Stulpnagel personally, this is particularly relevant because there is going to be testimony about a conversation that Dr. Stulpnagel had with Tony Zarnik in which he made certain disclosures about his experience with depression to Tony Zarnik.
In connection with?
It happened in the Saturday meeting, which we believe occurred at the end of April, and which Dr. Zarnik thinks happened at the end of May, or possibly June, or possibly April.
What happened at this meeting?
Dr. Stulpnagel was talking with Tony Zarnik. It was another counseling meeting. But with respect to the depression issue, Dr. Stulpnagel shared with Dr. Zarnik that he believed that he had a family member who had suffered from signs of depression and even made a statement to Dr. Zarnik that he himself, Dr. Stulpnagel, believes that at times he may have had, I won't say, Dr. Zarnik called it hypodepression. Dr. Stulpnagel never used that word, but said some of the mild signs of depression.
I think it's relevant.
I do, too.
And it's different than Dr. Zarnik trying to invoke the privacy interests of his own family.
Technically, it's not Dr. Stulpnagel's privacy interest.
I'm happy to have him limit his testimony by saying a member of my immediate family and not say what the familial relationship is.
I'll overrule the objection. Reconvene in 5 minutes. Record will indicate all the jurors are present, counsel and parties present. You may continue your examination.
Dr. Stulpnagel, do you have any family members or close acquaintances who either have been diagnosed with depression or take antidepressants?
Yes.
Can you elaborate upon that?
In fact, this is what's so insulting about this whole claim, is that in the April meeting with Dr. Zarnik, approximately 2 weeks after he disclosed depression, I talked to him about members of my immediate family that suffered from depression, were treated with antidepressants. I also have colleagues I work with, professional colleagues I work with at Illumina nearly every day who also suffer from depression.
Thank you. So I'm not going to replow each and every event that we've talked about or that Mr. Pantone asked you about, particularly because the judge has made it very clear that we, both Mr. Pantone and I, need to do a better job about moving the case along, and we're both going to try to do that.
Hold your applause, please.
Focusing on the April time frame, just to summarize, this was when the breakdown occurred, and a couple of days later, you learned from Mr. Zarnik he suffered from depression, right?
April 8th, I learned for the first time Dr. Zarnik suffered from depression.
Did you treat Dr. Zarnik any differently than you had before as a result of learning that he suffered from depression?
Not whatsoever.
Did you feel he was weak or incompetent as a result of learning that he suffered from depression?
No.
Did you conclude that you needed to rid Illumina of him as a result of learning that he suffered from depression?
Absolutely not.
And in fact, you have people that you work with in a professional capacity that suffer from the same condition?
Yes.
You haven't chosen to disassociate from those persons?
No.
Is there any particular activity, business activity, that you prevented Dr. Zarnik from engaging in as a result of learning that he had depression?
No.
Did you feel uncomfortable being around Dr. Zarnik as a result of learning that he had depression?
Absolutely not.
Now, Jay Flatley came on board in October of 1998, correct?
Correct.
When Mr. Flatley joined the company, or even before, did you give Mr. Flatley a briefing or rundown of your impressions of the other senior managers at Illumina?
No.
Why not?
A number of reasons. One is I was taking a unique step. I was taking a step backward, and now I was a colleague rather than the boss of the other senior managers. So it would seem inappropriate for me to go to Jay and say, this person is strong, this person is weak, when we're now all on the same exact level. The other is I wanted to be fair, and that is whatever prejudices I may have developed from performance-based issues that I had with my senior managers, I didn't want to transfer those to Jay. New boss, clean plate, professional, experienced senior manager. He would be able to draw his own conclusions. And mostly, I really did hope under new leadership that Dr. Zarnik's performance would improve.
Did you feel, for lack of a better word, did you feel like in any way that Dr. Zarnik's lack of performance under your leadership reflected negatively upon you?
I tried everything. I was fortunate to have family members that run businesses, and run very large businesses, and I had talked to them almost all the time and asked them how I can motivate this guy, what I can do to get more productivity from him. I tried different things, you know, casual walking conversation, a very directed counseling session. Nothing helped. I was inept at getting Dr. Zarnik to perform satisfactory at Illumina, and I was acting president CEO of the company, and I accept my responsibility for not getting him to perform better.
So what is the first point in time at which you had any discussion with Jay Flatley about your impressions of Dr. Zarnik's performance?
I believe that was in January of 2000, when Jay approached me and talked to me about what my impressions were regarding Dr. Zarnik's performance. We testified to that earlier, and that was the scientific advisory board meeting where Dr. Zarnik performed very poorly.
You attended? Did you attend that meeting?
No, I think I attended for a very short period of time. I knew all the scientific advisory board members. I recruited and identified most of them, so I had personal relationships, but I had other things that were pressing on my time.
Do you recall what portion of that January 2000 SAB meeting you attended?
No, I don't. It would probably have been the first part or the last part, and maybe lunch, because those are more social times.
When Dr. Flatley approached you to talk about Tony Zarnik after the January 2000 SAB meeting, what did you tell him?
Told him I...
Objection, hearsay.
It is hearsay. Does it come with an exception of the hearsay rule?
I'll ask another question. What was the general topic of discussion? The general topic of discussion that you and Mr. Flatley had?
Same objection.
Did you express any negative impressions?
I confided in Jay.
Objection. Hearsay.
This is really a denial of some allegations made by the other side at this point. Or what is this? What are you getting to?
It's testimony about the first occasion on which there was any discussion about Tony Zarnik's performance. I'll just move on.
It's hearsay, Judge. He said the timing is January of 2000.
The first time you discussed with Mr. Flatley any impressions of Tony Zarnik's performance was in January 2000.
Yes.
Had you, by that point, January 2000, had any discussion with Mr. Flatley about the fact that you knew that Tony Czarnik suffered from depression?
I never talked to Mr. Flatley about Tony Czarnik's depression up until Tony brought it up as an issue in April of 2000.
Now, you are aware, are you not, Dr. Stulpnagel, that at some point Dr. Czarnik stepped down as CSO?
Yes, I understand. Well, I knew Jay was meeting with him that evening to talk about him stepping down, and afterward, the next morning, Jay told me he didn't get through the meeting before Tony volunteered to step down, which was a pleasant surprise for Jay.
At this point in time, when you were aware Jay Flatley was going to have a discussion with Dr. Czarnik, had Jay Flatley suggested in any way, up to that point in time, that he wanted Tony Czarnik to leave the company entirely?
No. In fact, he thought because Tony was well-liked by the scientists, it was valuable to try to get Tony to stay.
And do you have any information one way or another whether Dr. Czarnik had ever offered to step down as CSO before the early 2000 timeframe?
I testified to those. One was in late March when he asked Dr. Mark Chi whether he should step down and have Dr. Mark Chi assume the role of CSO. The other is in the April 6th meeting when I thought he was having a breakdown and he volunteered to leave the company or volunteered to leave his position as CSO, whatever was best for Illumina.
So the offer to step down as CSO, made to Jay Flatley on September 7th during a dinner meeting, would have been the third occasion on which Dr. Czarnik offered to step down as CSO.
Yes.
And with respect to Dr. Czarnik's new position of research fellow, did you have any input in the decision to reduce his salary?
No.
Now, do you recall seeing an email from Tony Czarnik announcing to the company that he had elected to take the position of research fellow?
Yes.
We've seen that. I won't put it up. It's already in the record. At some point, Dr. Stulpnagel, did you come to learn that Tony Czarnik had resigned?
Yes. I understand that shortly after he sent out that email, he went to Jay and said, "I don't want to even be in the company anymore. I want to quit. But I want you to pay me all my stock that I haven't earned yet."
Is that a direct quote or paraphrased?
No, that's paraphrased.
I'll object. That's hearsay. Ask it be stricken from the record.
Granted.
Do you remember when it is that you came to have an understanding that Tony Czarnik had resigned?
It's all based on hearsay.
The initial question wasn't objected to.
What is significant about when this witness learned the plaintiff had resigned?
By the way, it's hotly contested as to whether he resigned, just so we're clear on that.
Timing and to the context of the various communications that were going on in the March-April timeframe.
Even according to Mr. Flatley, who claims there was a resignation, Dr. Stulpnagel wasn't present. It's all hearsay.
Just trying to establish the time, is that it?
Yes.
Why don't you just...
Also another conversation that corroborates that this occurred.
Just rephrase the question. Ask when he learned that the plaintiff was leaving the company and...
This communication, which you have referred to, is it something that you came to learn in passing? Or did Mr. Flatley make a special point of seeking you out to make the communication?
Mr. Flatley, in the best of my memory, March of 2000, came to me immediately and said, "Tony just volunteered to resign. He wants to negotiate a severance package."
Were you involved at all in the negotiation with Tony Czarnik of a severance package?
Only peripherally. I was part of the board, and I knew the severance negotiations were going on. The decisions were made by Mr. Flatley.
Were you also aware at this time that Mr. Pytoluski, an underperforming senior manager, had been asked to leave the company?
Yes.
Were you aware that a severance offer had been made to him?
Yes, and I believe that that severance offer was in consideration of an additional 3 months of consulting work that Mr. Pytoluski was going to provide the company after his termination.
Now, over the course of a period of time, March, perhaps into April of 2000, there were various communications between Mr. Flatley and Dr. Czarnik on the topic of a severance package. You indicated, Dr. Stulpnagel, that you are today and always have been a board member of Illumina, correct?
Yes.
So did you attend all the board meetings?
Yes.
And was there discussion held at the board level about the severance that would be offered to Tony Czarnik or that would be provided to him?
Yes.
And did those negotiations eventually reach an impasse?
Yes.
Are you aware that in April 2000, Dr. Czarnik sent an email to Jay Flatley in which he asserted that he had been discriminated against?
Yes.
How did you come to know that?
Jay asked me about this.
And did Jay ask you what he meant?
he was just confused because he had made the decision to reduce Dr. Zarnik's position from chief scientific officer to research fellow without any knowledge of any past discrimination. So he was confused why this allegation would be made. So he asked me, and I said, "Well, there's never been any discrimination against Dr. Zarnik, but I can think, I know what he's plotting here, that he's plotting to make a claim about discrimination, based upon the fact that he told me he suffered from depression about a year earlier."
"Object, Your Honor. It's hearsay, lacks foundation, and it's inadmissible opinion testimony."
"Sustained."
"Ask that it be stricken from the record."
"It's stricken. Jury admonished to disregard it."
The time Mr. Flatley came to you and communicated to you Tony Zarnik was claiming discrimination, isn't it true that the severance negotiations had been ongoing for over a month?
"That's right. This was just a blatant blackmail attempt."
"Same objection."
"Don't volunteer your opinions, please, Dr. Stulpnagel. I'm sure your counsel might want to argue that at the end of the case, but it's not proper for you to testify to that. Motion to strike is granted. The jury is admonished to disregard the testimony."
"Dr. Stulpnagel, after the severance negotiations reached an impasse, there's been testimony about the development of certain goals of Tony Zarnik's."
"Yes."
"One of the questions which Mr. Pantone put to you during his examination of you was whether there had been any work done in the company to date on binary oligo encoding. Do you remember that?"
"Yes."
"In assigning goals to individuals, Dr. Stulpnagel, do you routinely assign goals which have been partially met or partially performed by others?"
"Not routinely."
"Would you normally try to get people to strive to do something new?"
"Yes, and what's really important here is that there was a goal that absolutely had all the foundation built from the core technology that we're developing at Illumina. We were following oligo-based decoding, and converting it to binary oligo decoding was a natural progression. All the chemistry for attaining oligos had been worked out. All the fluorescent interactions, binding interactions, all worked out. We can synthesize oligos easily. So all the resources that Dr. Zarnik had at hand made this a much more reasonable goal than the one he proposed himself, an antibody-antigen mechanism."
"Mr. Pantone asked you about a resume which he put up on the board, and you testified about it. And in that resume, you referred to yourself as a founder."
"Yes."
"Is that your standard working resume?"
"I don't have a working resume. I had the good fortune to have been employed in the summer of 1999 by Avalon, and continued in that relationship as they were acquired by CW Group, continued in that relationship as I started Illumina, or helped start Illumina, and then continued at Illumina. So for 6 years, 5 years, I've never applied for a job."
"And your creation of the resume, which we saw, is that something which you initiated and did on your own initiative, or were you specifically asked to prepare it?"
"No. Our human resources department was collecting current resumes from every employee. I'd been negligent in getting that to them. I had been busy. I didn't want to take the time to write it up. Very quickly, on a Saturday afternoon, I threw this thing together, shot it to them, and now they have something on record for me."
"Now, Dr. Stulpnagel, were you... You've testified already about a board of directors meeting in which you believe in June of 2000, Jay Flatley was asked whether Tony Zarnik was going to meet the goals that had been assigned to him."
"Yes."
"Remember your testimony on that? You've attended every board of directors meeting, correct?"
"Correct."
"Has there ever been a board of directors meeting in which Jay Flatley, so this certainly narrows the time frame, any board of directors meeting after Jay Flatley joined the company, in which he suggested or said to the board that Tony Zarnik didn't know it yet, but he would be given goals that he couldn't attain, or words to that effect?"
"Absolutely not."
"Now, you participated in being part of the roadshow team, correct?"
"Correct."
"And with respect to that process, Dr. Stulpnagel, were there any representations made to investors on the roadshow about the actual number of beads that Illumina was decoding?"
"None."
"Were there any questions on that topic?"
"No."
"Were there any representations made that there was an experiment that was being conducted throughout much of year 2000 called the 768 decoding experiment?"
"Yes."
"Is that true?"
"Yes."
"Did you ever refer to that experiment as the Roadshow experiment?"
"Never."
"Are you aware of any person other than Tony Zarnik who has referred to that experiment as the Roadshow experiment?"
"No."
And you testified this morning that the 768 decoding experiment was merely a continuation of prior decoding experiment series. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We've done a 16-bead decoding experiment?
Yes.
Then a 128-bead decoding experiment?
Yes.
And then the 768?
I think there might have been a 256 between that.
Okay. And during this roadshow, apart from a general description of decoding and a statement that decoding works, was there any scientific data presented regarding decoding?
No.
Now, with respect to the alleged whistleblower claim, did Dr. Zarnik ever, during or after the roadshow, approach you about what had been said to investors on the roadshow?
No.
Did Dr. Zarnik, during the roadshow or at any point thereafter, express to you any concern about the fact that the roadshow team had received data from the 768 experiment while on the roadshow?
Never.
Do you have any reason to believe that Dr. Zarnik approached any other person who was on the roadshow with such concerns?
Object. That calls for speculation.
Do you have any information?
Mark Chi joined the roadshow on the very last day, and I'd seen an email that Dr. Zarnik had sent to Dr. Mark Chi.
That email was sent to Mark Chi on September 5th, the date on which Dr. Zarnik was terminated, correct?
Correct.
Now, Dr. Stulpnagel, you have a background in biochemistry. You have training in biology and chemistry, correct?
Correct.
So do you understand scientifically the design of the 768 bead decoding experiment?
I wouldn't qualify myself as an expert, but I think I have a pretty good understanding of the experiment, yes.
We will be hearing from other witnesses in more detail about that experiment, but let me ask you, based upon your knowledge of chemistry, biochemistry, etc., molecular biology, and knowing that there was mislabeling of some of the dye vials that were used in that experiment, based upon that knowledge, do you think that the scientific results of the 768 decode experiment were useless?
I'll object on basis of lack of foundation. There's no evidence. In fact, I believe Dr. Stulpnagel never worked on these experiments.
You understand what the mechanism is?
Absolutely.
Objection overruled.
I think that...
The question is based upon your understanding of the experimental design and knowing, it's undisputed in this case, knowing that a few of the dye vials were mislabeled. Did that mean that the results were useless and couldn't be interpreted?
Absolutely not. In fact, the conclusions were absolutely perfectly legitimate. The labeling mistake did not impact the conclusions, and the fact that we routinely, in manufacturing, build arrays that have over 1,500 different beads that have to be decoded on every array is proof that the experiment was completely valid.
Now, Dr. Stulpnagel, Mr. Pantone asked you how many shares of Illumina stock you hold. Do you remember that?
Yes.
How much capital, how much of your own personal money, have you invested in Illumina today?
I think it's in excess of $150,000.
And how much money have you made on the sale of any stock?
I have not sold a single share of Illumina stock, so zero.
And if you were to use the amount invested by you and look at the value of that stock as of today, have you lost or gained money?
I've got paper gains.
Okay, but you haven't actually sold a single share of stock.
I haven't realized any gains, so I'm out cash considerably.
Now, understanding that you may have some paper gains, whether those hold or not will depend upon what the market does, right?
That's correct.
Have you in any way significantly altered your lifestyle in terms of cars, houses, anything of that nature?
Objection.
Sustained.
Nothing further, subject, of course, to the redirect.
Does this mean I have 12 minutes, Judge, give or take?
Give or take.
You only wanted 10.
As long as we leave enough time for her redirect.